I'm going to start from a continuum model and then kind of try to go down. And what I'm going to leave open is actually how to properly make this connection to the atomistic level of the problem. And I'm just going to tell you in here about the continuum model, which is a little bit ad hoc. This is a team of people I've been involved with: theorists, some atomistic guys, a couple of scattering people, and TM and chemistry people. At all of them are at Northwestern. So this is the system which we've been interested in for a couple of years now. I think they actually started. I joined them in 2009, and they've been looking at this for 3 or 4 years before I joined them. So what they do, they take this palmitic acid, which is shown in here, and mix it with the palmitic acid, which is actually functionalized with lysine molecules. Taken independently, these are other, I would say, boring molecules. These guys actually even not soluble, they actually form precipitate in the solution. These guys form micelles. But if you mix them together in a right stoichiometry, you get these very interesting vesicular shapes, which are roughly 100 to 200 nanometers across, single bilayer vesicles. This image was taken in 2009 by Megan Greenfield. And this is TEM image where Megan dries the sample and then makes the image mask in platinum and then images it. This one was taken really recently by Liam Palmer, and this is what is called deep freeze quick etch technique. So he actually rapidly freezes water, which is where this is suspended in, and then just images the vesicles. Of course, first thing which pops into mind is does the imaging technique destroy the effect shape? And the experimentalists are very proud to tell me that they are certain, or they're very convinced that it does not affect the shape, that this is actual shape which you would find it in a solution. What is striking in here is that we actually see faceted structures. That's what I find really interesting. If you ask me why do we see layers in here, we don't understand this at the moment. So the goal is actually to try to understand this faceting of these type of systems. So then we give these samples to our colleagues who do the small angle and wide angle X-ray spectroscopy. And just to remind you, this is a typical SexFex type of diagram. In here we plot the scattering momentum. So as momenta goes, it's inversely proportional to the length. So the smaller momenta correspond to larger length scales, and the larger momenta correspond to lower length scales. So this is a composite plot for vesicles with 2-to-1, so essentially one lysine molecule chopped off, or all three of them. And what is like, and just as a reference, just purely cation, which actually forms the micelles. So from the small angle part, which is this part on the left, they can fit the slope of the curve to the Porat's law, and the exponent is, if I remember correctly, something of the order 1.97, which tells them that that we actually have a bilayer structure. And from this region in here, they can actually determine that the bilayer structure is roughly 4 nanometers thick. So that's what this tells us. What is actually far more interesting is what happens at the wide angle range, so large momenta, so smaller length scales. What they see are these peaks. These are actually Bragg peaks, which actually tell us that these lipid molecules actually are ordered in a crystalline structure. If you're wondering what are these are just copy pasted from the picture above. Yes. So and what else? So there are peaks. There is crystalline structure, and from the width of the peak, they actually determine that these crystalline structures on the surface of a vesicle have a correlation like roughly 25 nanometers. So they're kind of like small facets on the surface of the...
You don't mean liquid crystalline? It's just
crystal.
Really a solid?
Yes. Yeah, it's a solid. And actually what is interesting, something which I'm not going to go into much in here, is that as you change pH, you have a structural phase transition. So at very low and very high pH, you see hexagonal lattice, and in between you see rectangular C structure. So there is actually phase transition, a structural phase transition somewhere inside of the bilayer as you change pH. And we think we understand it in terms of the electrostatics, but I'm not going to go into that in here. So what is interesting in here, so in a kind of like, So I have a crystalline order, which lives at the angstrom scales, or a couple of angstrom scales, which is actually, I believe, going to affect the structure of the vesicle at the 100 nanometers or so. And I'm going to actually try to address the fact in what comes is the faceting, actually the structure of the whole vesicle, without actually making some rather crude assumption about what's going on in here. So let me remind you that if you have a vesicle, and if you have a sphere, and if you want to put a crystal on it, this is actually not that easy to do. Or to be really precise, you cannot do it without introducing topological defects into the problem, and that's simply the consequence of spherical topology. These are just some deep mathematical topological statements. And then, if you have such topological defects in a crystalline lattice, they are actually going to introduce a certain amount of strain. And under right conditions, this strain can be relieved by actually faceting. And you typically.
The picture, of course, is clear, but how many molecules do we have in such a vesicle type of structure?
This one would be. This was actually done. This was done for viruses by Lidmar.
Of your
system. So it's 100 nanometers vesicle across. So, and the typical distance between the two lipids is something like half a nanometer, let's say. So I have like what, 0.40, 100,000, yeah, a couple hundred thousand, yeah.
So does this approach then apply? Because if you have a 2D crystal, you probably have many defects anyhow in your system.
That is exactly. You're actually just continuing my talk. Exactly. Yes. So that is exactly the point. I'm actually putting this in here to emphasize that once when you deal with crystals on a lattice or a sphere, you have to worry about things like this. And in general, so even if I were to be able to actually like in viruses to make a perfect crystal, I would still have to deal with these topological defects. And as I make a vesicle bigger or thinner, it would buckle. So somehow I actually have to in what I'm going to say, I have to disentangle this effect, potential this effect, from what I see. And to my surprise, this was actually not done before. So the point is, it was worked out in late 80s by Seung and Nelson, and it turns out that if you have this dimensionless ratio of the radius to thickness, if it is of the order of 100, the vesicle buckles. So how do we understand this? These topological defects, which we have, are so-called disclination defects. So you can think of it as taking a hexagon and then cutting out one wedge, essentially like cutting like one wedge of pizza, and what is remaining, you just put it together. And this is clearly going to introduce strain in the problem. And now you can actually do energetics, so you can actually calculate the elastic energy of such system. So I have two possibilities. Either this stays flat, and then I pay stretching energy. And if you calculate this stretching energy goes quadratic. It's actually rather easy to show to show the scaling. Getting a prefactor in front is a little bit more tricky. Or the other option is to get a party cone, essentially to get a cone. If you get a cone, then you can show that the energies goes logarithmically with the size of the object. Again, also relatively easy to show the scaling, but not that easy to calculate the prefactor. And Seung and Nelson calculated that this transition happens again when the ratio of the Young modulus to the bending rigidity is of the order of 100 or so. As I mentioned, our vesicles are not really icosahedral. They are faceted, and they don't look like icosahedral. They look more like some kind of random polyhedral objects. So can we actually understand this in terms of defects, or what kind of defects can we understand this? This is clearly not this type of physics where we have the topological. This just this 12 simple topological defects. And so I'm now gonna make a big leap. And I'm going to make an assumption that indeed I have this kind of facet type of structures which are 25 nanometers across, and where they meet, there will be some kind of defect. So there will be some kind of mismatch between the crystalline structure of two neighboring defects. So some kind of a grain boundary. And I'm going to assume that along this grain boundary, the system is softer. And this is just going to be assumption in this continuum model which I'm going to build. I'm not going to actually... the continuation of this study would be actually to try to justify this from a more atomistic or more kind of particular type of approach to the problem. So
if you go back to your previous slide where you had the pizza coin.
Yes.
So what you're saying now is, in fact, you have some kind of a non-linear bending elasticity
where if you bend a lot, it doesn't cost much more. And so it is profitable to have these faceted objects and not the homogeneously bent object
exactly.
And be in the null space.
I'm just gonna have regions which are softer, and I'm guessing that they live, and this is just a guess at the moment, that they're living where these two plates are meeting each other, because you just have a crystalline mismatch between crystalline orientations. Between there is no reason that the vesicle crystallizes into a unique single crystal on a whole sphere. Actually, it cannot because of spherical topology, and I'm gonna do it within the elasticity theory of elasticity, so it's going to be a triangulated. So I'm going to represent my vesicle as a triangulated surface, which is going to have hard facet and soft boundaries. I'm going to do a trick to actually remove the possibility toward buckling into a icosahedron, so that I can know that whatever I get is actually comes from these two effects. It has nothing to do with these topological defects, which actually have to be there. So that's the idea.
So that assumes that in both layers you have the same kind of grains.
Yes.
Are they so strongly coupled, or can you imagine a situation where you have different grain structure and then the two different layers?
Probably one could, but not at this resolution. Because this is really this in here, I'm actually representing the whole vesicle, the whole wall as a single.
You require this or request this in order to have these soft lines.
Yes. Yeah.
Properly located, and then for this, I think you request that the grain boundaries on both sides are the same.
You're right. Yes.
So the physical reason that they are the same.
Do you actually request that?
Couldn't the grain boundary be just a signature of being different on both sides?
Do you think that's sufficient?
That's actually all a good question, you know. And again, this is something really which has to be answered with a much higher resolution. So I need kind of like to probe onto much higher resolution of the actual structure of the wall. In here, I'm just trying to build the. An elastic model, which by hand I am assuming that there are two components.
Different crystal structures on the left and on the right side.
The upper and the lower.
Upper lower. You have
bilayer. He always works with bilayers.
True. Yes, sir.
And both bilayers are crystallized. Yeah. And the question is how the domains of the grains in each layer are identical on both sides, or can they be different? What consequence does it have for this?
It would seem to be a more natural assumption given that the whole vesicle lives under one particular set of temperatures, pressures, yada yada, to assume that everything that's a flat facet is an identical crystal structure.
Yes.
If that's not the case, it's more unnatural, I would think.
The facet, I think, is fine, but when you approach to what he has as soft boundaries, is then the upper and the lower still the same?
I assume you can't resolve that anyway.
Yeah, at this level, certainly I cannot, because at the moment, this is actually mathematical study. This is mathematical triangulated structure in here. You know, and this is actually a very good question. This is something which we actually try to do someone else tried to do some atomistic simulations, and then we just don't have enough, you know, we cannot do big enough patch. So we need something, some kind of coarse graining to look into.
That's sort of the fine-grained theory that explains the kind of non-linear
elasticity. Exactly, yes. Yeah.
In fact, we did this with martini lipids, mm-hmm. where we can actually freeze small liposomes, and you can actually see that they form these facets.
Did you publish that?
That was published.
I have to. Okay, great.
Then you can really see the molecular detail. And you're right, they form these facets with soft kind of layers of just a few lipids that are molten.
Yeah. Well, appreciate if you could give me reference. Thank you. Okay, so from now on, it's just essentially mathematics and okay. So now, how am I going to do this? I'm going to use this model of thin sheets. So I'm going to derive I'm just going to borrow it, the expression for the energy, for the bending and stretching energy of an elastic object, two-dimensional elastic object. So you start with something which has two lateral dimensions which are large compared to thickness. And in here, I'm going to use this what is called Kirchhoff-Love assumptions. Under these assumptions, I can actually go integrate out the direction thickness and represent the elasticity in terms of the two-dimensional surface. So Kirchhoff-Love assumptions is that the body is a state of plane stress. So all stresses are in this plane. There is nothing up and down. And after the deformation, after you bend, all the points stay on the same normal. So there is no slide from one normal to another. And I think actually that the expression itself was probably derived sometime in the early 1900s by John Love von Karman or Foppel. But in this form, it was actually put together in the 60s by Keuter. So the idea is that you start from a expressions for a three-dimensional elastic energy, and then you just integrate out the thickness. So what you end up with the expression given in terms of the neutral surface of a two-dimensional object, which has two terms. The strain tensor, which tells me how much energy I pay to stretch this object, and this is the second fundamental form, which related to the curvature tensor, which tells me how much energy it costs me to actually bend the object, and they come with the prefactors of thickness and thickness to the power of 3. So all the information about the material is actually buried in this rank four tensor, which is actually elastic tensor.
If you write something like this, how can you say it's in a state of plane stress? Once you have bending, you would think you would always get normal stresses.
This is actually a good question. This is something which let's talk about that. Because this is something which actually bugs me also. But this is something which again, you know, like you take any of these, there is quite a bit of literature on this, and that's what people take. These are these two assumptions.
Can solve that in different mechanical assumptions. Either you assume that the edges stay normal, so you bend it and the edges stay normal, or you allow the edges to curve with it. And these two types of solutions you can write more or less in that way, they differ by the
case. Yeah. So I'm gonna now assume, because in order to actually move on. So in principle, this is now variation. So if I want to find the structure of my object, I can actually, you know, take what the notes which Marcus wrote on the differential geometry, get all the formulas from there, do the variational calculation, get a set of partial differential equations, and then I start crying because they're highly nonlinear. I take like 9 of them or something like that. So instead of that, I'm just going to put all of this on a computer. And I'm also going to be very bold, and I'm just going to say that everything is isotropic. Again, just to be able to make any progress. So I'm going to assume that these guys are actually isotropic, so then I have only two Lamé coefficients to deal with. And then if you do this, then the stretching and bending energy become very, very simple. So this is just a trace of the strain tensor squared, and this is just a trace of a square of a strain tensor. And in here, bending energy looks a little bit like Helfrich energy, where we have a mean curvature and Gaussian curvature. Now in this formulation, I can actually now discretize my surface and represent it as a bunch of triangles. The advantage is that now I can actually define the metric, the local kind of discrete metric, which is just a matrix, like 2x2 matrix, which actually has the dot products of the two sides of a triangle before and after deformation. And if I introduce this quantity, which I borrowed from Parinello and Raman's famous paper on molecular dynamics with shear, you can write the stretching discrete version of the stretching energy rather elegantly. and simply, which is actually very, very easy to calculate numerically. So all I need to do is give a give some kind of reference metric to my system, give some kind of say like by hand, I say like this has actually zero stretching energy, this state, and then whenever my as my system evolves, I calculate what is the actual metric, calculate value of this tensor, put it inside, and here we go, I get my stretching energy. So in this way, I actually removed the effects of topological of these 12 topological defects which I measured, which I mentioned at the very beginning, because I'm actually choosing my reference metric such that it corresponds to my reference sphere, my initial condition sphere. This is just actually a trick to get around the problem of that I have to disentangle the effects of grain boundaries versus the topological defects which have to be there because I have a triangulated surface of a sphere. So just a mathematical trick to go around. And now you can actually wonder how to discretize this thing. It was done by a number of people. I like the discretization of Sang and Nelson. It was also done by Gomper and Kroll. All of this is done in 80s and 90s. So this first term can be easily discretized in terms of the two normals. So you have your discrete surface, which is a bunch of triangles. And then to each triangle, you associate a normal. And then the dot product between two normals gives you how much gives you the curvature. So essentially, if I do this, so I just dot product my normals, this doesn't cost me any energy. And as I increase the angle, it costs me more and more energy. And this was done, as I mentioned, by Sang and Nelson. And I'm also left with one more term, which is this Gaussian curvature term. And now you can say, like, well, you typically don't worry about Gaussian curvature because something called Gauss-Bonnet theorem tells me that if I don't change topology, and in here I'm not changing topology, I'm not drilling any holes, then the Gaussian curvature integrates to a constant. But this is true only if this number here is a constant. So if I can take this number in front of the integral. And in here, this is not the case because I have two-component system. So I actually have to worry about the grain, about the boundaries, about the values of the curvature in the boundary, something called geodesic curvature. So I cannot really kind of like swipe under the rug this whole term. I actually have to take care of the presence of the Gaussian curvature in the system just to be consistent. And numerically calculating Gaussian curvature is actually rather straightforward. You take what is called a vertex star, so vertex and its triangles, and then you calculate the angular deficit. So just add all the angles in here and subtract this from 2 pi, and that miraculously gives you the value for the Gaussian curvature. So now, when the model is in place, I can actually do the optimization, and we do it using Monte Carlo code, simulated annealing optimization. So I start from a spherical vesicle with a random distribution of blue and white triangles, white being hard triangles, blue being soft triangles. These guys actually, these are kind of infinitesimal, physically infinitesimal elements of my model. These guys representing hard facets or elements of hard facets. These guys representing elements which would live along the edges. And then do two types of Monte Carlo moves. The first one is I take a vertex at random and replace it by a certain amount, accept or reject according to metropolis. And also I'm a bit ambitious in here, so not only that I want to optimize the shape, but I also want to optimize the distribution of the components. So I actually want to start from a random distribution of the components and see where they want to go. And in order to do that, I do the swap move, where I just swap the two types of the triangles.
Why is this conserved? I mean, we had phase transitions in your lipid bilayer, so I mean, I can have as many of one type or of another type. I mean, if not, was that a composition thing, no?
It could be Grand canonical, of course, and the simple answer is, I'm going to show you in the next slide that even with a canonical, I get very interesting structures. So it's at this moment it's simpler to do canonical simulation. There is absolutely no problem of actually introducing the move where I would actually change the nature of the triangle, make this guy white, for example, or so.
So we were imagining that one of these triangles corresponds to a local concentration of one kind
exactly.
of lipid,
yes,
and
yeah.
the other one to another
yes,
kind
yeah.
of lipid, and
yeah.
the total numbers in the
it's
whole
triangle. Yes, yeah, yeah.
So I was assuming you would now do something to the curvature term or to the edges, but now you do it on the area. So now you're introducing a length scale or a discretization scale into the thing, which I cannot relate to anything
you've so it is actually it's a good question. It's a good point. So in here, I use in a previous work, we actually worked with when the component was defined on the edge, which is easier to relate to what is in what I talked about before. But the in here, defining it on a triangle is a pure convenience because of the way how I calculate the metric. I know how to calculate the metric of a triangle. I don't know how to calculate the metric of an edge, or it's not trivial. So, in a sense, as my statement is, as long as this triangle is small enough, it should not matter.
Because if you go back to your equations for the energies that you had, and you know, sort of, mm-hmm. I always do things with
yeah.
polymers, right? And if when we were playing with things that could buckle, I mean,
yeah,
light
yeah.
chains that can have kinks, the simplest thing to do is to say, well, you take an expression which has the same the first order expansion, so
mm-hmm.
the quadratic term is always the same, but then if you say it's 1 minus the square of the angle, or you take
mm-hmm.
the cosine of the angle, or you take something else, you can do this in such a way that on a linear scale is always the same, but
yeah.
nonlinear elasticity is drastically different, and it gives you more or less kinking. And I was expecting you, actually, I think you were expecting the same, to do
yeah.
the same trick here, and you just say, okay, I know what my linear terms have to be, but then I can make them I can get very different behavior by allowing for nonlinear elasticity.
Well, actually, this is a nonlinear elasticity, and there is actually the nonlinearity in here is hidden in the geometric terms of this, because the strain tensor as it is written has actually these mixed terms, so that's where nonlinearity comes in.
I think what Ralph means is instead of having a Helmholtz Hamiltonian-like thing that looks like k squared,
yeah,
you have something which for small k looks like k squared, but for large k suddenly it's lambda squared.
Sure. Yes, but that's
apparently that doesn't make any difference for you.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. 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 I will probably be worth looking into. This is at the moment done as just having a Helmholtz term, because this is this comes from this integrating of the along the thickness. Yes. So I think the point is in here that this is essentially just a mathematical convenience how to model this. That's how I think about this triangle. That's why this is all defined on a triangle. And as I said in a previous work, we actually looked into a system where the components are defined on the edges, which is easier to kind of relate to the actual experiment, but it's harder to actually relate to the equations which I wrote on the previous slide. So if you do this, here is so in here I'm changing the relative ratio of the bending rigidities, which is I assume relative thickness. Clearly, in the experiment, there is not much variation in the thickness of the membrane. This softness comes from most likely from the orientation of the molecules. But for mathematical convenience, it's in a model like this, it's easier to assume that I have different thicknesses, and that's how I control the local bending rigidity of the system. So if you go left, middle, right, we have a different ratios of the thicknesses, and if I go from the top to the bottom, I'm changing the relative concentration of the soft to hard component, and again, I don't make any assumptions. So I start from a spherical configuration which has the random distribution of the. So I have start from a white sphere which has a random distribution of the blue triangles, and then let the system evolve. Let my Monte Carlo lead me to what I call typical structure. I'm not going to call it minimum energy because there is no way that I know that this is actual global minimum, but it's a typical in a sense that's reproducible, at least qualitatively reproducible, and we see that. You know, facet starts to emerge. So we actually see faceted structures. Are they identical to what we see in experiments? No, but I wasn't expecting them to be identical. What I wanted to show is that you can actually get a faceting of the system by simply assuming that you have two components, and then it can be actually driven by the physics different than this sound Nelson buckling of the CDD at the topological defects. You can now look into energetics. So not surprisingly, both stretching and bending energies are condensated along these edges. So it's kind of an example of energy focusing.
Is there a constraint on the volume of the large conformation?
In this case, there is no constraint, but there is not much fluctuation in volume. Maybe like the whole thing maybe shrinks like 2% or something like that. I can easily put a constraint on a volume and nothing much changes.
Because if you take out volume, then what you would probably observe is a more macroscopic phase separation with sort of one part having more or less curvature. And if you think about these stars being two component vesicles, mm-hmm. then I think that's what they do.
Well, if we saw that in a different model, but we needed to actually add line tension between them. If you actually add the line tension between two components, so if I say like that there is a penalty of mixing white and blue, then in a sizable part of parameter region, I see separation. And then you get very interesting fractures. You get like one which is curved and the other one which is faceted, and so on and so on.
The absence of a volume constraint is probably physically very meaningful in that context. I assume you constrain the area.
Area is essentially constrained by elasticity, because there is an elastic penalty of changing the area of a triangle.
You said it's meaningful or it's not meaningful?
It is meaningful. Because these things, after all, are very transparent to water.
Okay. Yeah.
Even in the crystalline state?
Well, I'm not sure about the crystalline state, but let's remember that also.
Well, the macroscopic timescale of water can permeate, but you also have to worry about the balance between the number of bits you have in the inner monolayer and the outer monolayer, because that is a kind of a constraint. Because this flip-flopping of lipids will be very slow on the experimental timescale. So that could be put in as a constraint.
What would be as
the overall volume, I think, can
In here, there is in here in none of the simulations there was any constraint on the volume. It's simple to why this is implemented, and I tried to play with it, and there is no qualitative difference.
What Sivajan means that might be a constraint mm-hmm. of the integrated mean curvature, but you could put this in if you wanted.
Yeah. Something to think about, yes.
The model that we are using here is an elastic model.
Yes. Yeah.
You are assuming that this for example, yellow is a crystal structure. On the other hand, that you are assuming that the sphere is made of two components and they can diffuse up and
Again, I'm assuming diffusion in a sense of a Monte Carlo way to get to the optimal structure. I'm not. It's just a optimization scheme to get a thermodynamic, to get what I believe would be the minimum energy structure. It's
basically red and yellow consist of different.
Well, in here, red and yellow correspond to the different value of the energy on the surface. So in this case, for this is bending energy. So since this is a face, that there is no energy, there is no bending energy, it's semi-flat. And the most of the bending energy is actually concentrated, focused along the edge, which is to be expected, because if I have two faces which meet, that's where more curvature is, and that's where more curvature energy. More.
I'm a bit confused about this model. So mm-hmm. Is this two component system or just one
component?
Two component system.
Yes.
Two kinds of molecules.
Now we have to be careful what I mean by two components. There and the in the experimental system, there are actually two kinds of molecules, but they are as we what we believe from the measurements is that they are actually mixed on the microscopic scale together. So there is you actually have a plus three and three plus minus ones around. What I refer in here by two components is more of an artificial construct, meaning one component being soft and corresponding to the regions of the vesicles which are ordered, which are structured. And what I call component number two is actually one name for all what is going on, all complicated physics which is going on at the grain boundaries between such components.
So that is actually that this you are modeling that this nonlinear system as a boundary.
So I'm modeling whole vesicle with the nonlinear elastic theory.
I think the best way to think about this particular case is what Mike has suggested, that you have a mixture of two different lipids, they phase separate, and one lipid ends up making a very stiff face, and the other lipid ends up making a very soft face.
That's again,
the soft lipids end up at these edges, and that's what the thing kinks. And then probably as a function of time, you would get some coarsening of these things, and that's the difficult thing after that gets done.
Except that there is no line tension in this case, right?
So why did you not include line tension? Because that would be natural for also between a gel or a crystal lipid and a fluid lipid. You would expect a line tension.
Yeah, but isn't that implicitly part of this? Because
no,
when you have a localized gating energy, which scales in some sense now effectively with the length of these kinks, and when you now put a line tension in there, you get another term which scales with the length of these kinks. I could imagine you ultimately end up effectively.
Yeah,
like it has the wrong sign.
Why does it have the wrong sign?
Because if you have the ordinary line tension, you would have phase separation, it just goes into one spot. Then what you have is, in order to minimize these elastic terms, this stuff sort of nicely distributes over the overall surface. Right? It's just the other way around. The effective line tension, in fact, is
the competition of these two
formulas. If you want your wings, then the bending is maybe a little bit smaller than you would think it would be.
Exactly, but if you had this energy, it would change the result.
Yes, and we've done that. I can show you the paper where we actually study this. What happens if you add actual line tension to the similar model?
Use the experimental images because there the facets are much larger, I guess.
Yes.
So have an overall very spherical vesicle.
Yes, this is very spherical. In here, I actually I was more concentrating on to do the to try to show that the in within a nonlinear elastic theory with just two components, I can get faceting. I can show you the models which we did, which are more where, as I mentioned, which we put components onto the edges and we introduce line tension, where we actually see that you can actually by introducing line tension, changing line tension, you go from a picture like this to segregation of the or different parts of the on the vessel.
Yeah, okay, but the segregation would not model your system that you're interested in, right? Because
in that
you don't have a real separation of a liquid and a.
No, I don't believe we do.
Solid state in one component vessel.
Yeah, no, we don't. Yeah, that's true. And then one can actually, you know, like if you don't believe that this is faceted, you can actually look into the distribution of the mean curvature. For example, on the surface, a polar plot. This mass in here is just interpolation. As it turns out, it's not that trivial to do interpolation on a sphere for whatever reason. And you see that the curvature is focused. So there are regions which have low curvature, which are flat, and which have bent, and you can do the same for the Gaussian curvature. If you ask me why Gaussian curvature goes to negative a little bit, why do I have a saddle points? I think this is just simply not equilibrated enough. Maybe there is something deeper in there, but I just simply think that this is just not patient enough to wait.
Faceted polyhedra do not have to have vertices, all of which have a positive Gaussian curvature. There's no need for that. If you look at a T3 capsid, for instance, it has points with
negative
which have funny saddles on it.
Yeah. Okay, then that's probably. Even just looking into surface, occasionally see kind of like saddles, a little bit of saddles. And I think just simply, but if you say so, I believe you.
No, hang on, that's not a general theory.
Yeah. So that's about it. So in general, I think I hope I convinced you that the using two component a system within a nonlinear elastic theory, classical nonlinear elastic theory, I can get the vesicles to facet. So that was the idea. So now the problem which I wanna focus more on is to try to justify this from a more atomistic level. Clearly we cannot do this fully atomistically. As Marco said, like there's like more than 100,000 molecules in there, so there's no way that we're going to simulate a full vesicle. But doing something in between would maybe Bertini would be actually the way to go and try to model a full vesicle and see if it actually wants to facet.
I thought there's some reasonable couple of years back, and I just very faintly remember work by the group of David Nelson, who said, well, the only defect you talked about today is a dislocation.
Yes, yeah.
It's a very high energy, but there are other things, the dislocations, which is the pairing of a 5 and a 7.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yes, and which add up basically to no effect at all. But what you can, what they showed you can get is that if you have this cunation, and this defect is kind of surrounded and screened by a whole bunch of dislocations, which add up.
Yeah, you have the so-called scars, yes, yeah.
Aligning in lines.
Yes, yeah.
You get these kind of defect boundary, which is basically 5, 7, 5, 7, 5, 7, 5.
Yes,
7.
Yeah. And then it terminates.
And what?
Then it terminates.
And then it terminates.
Yeah, yes, exactly, yes, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, that was the work from 2000. It was like Alex Traveset and David Nelson and Mark Bovic.
Oh, okay.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm aware of it, yes, yeah. And this is actually a good question. One of the postdocs in our group is working on answering what happens to this Sam-Nelson transition, the buckling transition in the presence of those topological defects, those actually extra scar defects. Yeah, I think that summarizes. Thank you.